to book the show, it takes a month.
Yeah.
So we've been off for maybe 2, maybe 3 months. I don't know.
Yeah, a long time. Too long. We've missed you.
We have. And we're happy to be back. We had a great guest for this first episode of the number of series. Matt.
This is 4 now.
I think it's 4. We just passed our anniversary.
Happy birthday.
It was in March, yeah. But guys, we had Matt Ricardo on.
We did.
Matt Ricardo is a all-around fabulous entertainer, and I know him through doing Comedy Club for Kids, doing various burlesque shows. He's a juggler. Absolutely fabulous man.
And writes interesting stuff about comedy.
Yeah.
I've read lots of his articles about comedy and performance and that sort of thing.
Yeah, he's a writer. He recently diagnosed autistic.
Yes.
And we talked a little bit about retrospection and looking back after you receive a diagnosis. And that being said, we decided that right before we started recording, and we're still not sure if retrospection is a word.
It is a word.
I think it is.
Sounds good, doesn't it?
But I said it, so now I'm questioning myself.
No, it's becoming a word. Words don't exist, do they? You say a word and then it becomes...
Exactly.
That's how words come into place. We're like Shakespeare of... Or it is a word and we're just copying someone else. But, either way, we're covered.
Yeah, but Shakespeare, he did make up a lot of words. Him and Dr. Seuss.
I'm always fascinated by that. When people go, oh, Shakespeare invented the word assassination.
Wait, he invented the word assassination specifically?
So, like, that's one of the ones that I always remember, that Shakespeare invented the word assassination.
I thought it was always French.
It's not. It's but in the play that is in, was it really confusing at the time that they went... There's a bit in the play where they go, oh, shit, there's been an... Probably not shit, but oh, no, there's been an assassination. The audience not watching that going, been a what? Because they don't know what that word is.
I guess so. But then again, how often do you watch something and you don't really understand what a word is, but you know within the context of the situation? You know what I mean?
So there's always context around it where you see an assassination and someone goes, oh, look, an assassination. They're pointing at it.
Yeah.
And then you get the, that must be a... Right.
I always call my partner Tom incorrigible. And he doesn't know what it means.
I don't really either. No, it's said in Parliament, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. I think I know what it means. And then he goes, I don't know what that word means. And I could tell you he's incorrigible. I cannot give you a definition of incorrigible.
Right. It's not good.
It's
not like a horrible thing to say.
No, it's someone
cheeky?
Who like willfully acts against authority.
Right.
Yeah. And is like their behavioral problems are unfixable.
Right. Okay.
So like if you were to call a young kid incorrigible, they would be like a troublemaker who will not be able to turn it around and not be a troublemaker.
So it's sort of cheeky. I said that to be a bit silly, but that is sort of what it is. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, cool. We're learning. We're so educational.
Look at this.
Yeah.
We should be like Sesame Street, and each episode will be brought to you by a letter.
A different letter.
Yeah. Today is R for retrospection.
Lovely. Here's Matt Ricardo.
Here we go.
I thought, this is so dumb, I thought that once I got my diagnosis, it would be, right, well, that's that done.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was the end of the journey, but of course it's the beginning of the journey. Mm-hmm. Again, I'm an idiot. So, yeah, it's that thing, and I guess it must be very common for this kind of diagnosis, that as soon as you get your diagnosis, it just reframes your entire life up to that point, which for me is a long time because I'm old. You know, so suddenly, you know, the way that I kind of phrased it at the time was all these little things that you thought were your kind of unique little special personality traits, mm-hmm. and stuff, and all your little weirdsies and, all those little things are all suddenly collected under one title. And that title is symptoms. And it's suddenly weird. Because it's like, oh, but I thought I was interesting, but it's a disability. So what of me is left? And
that's so interesting, because that's like the opposite of the story that I hear a lot, is people go, oh, I thought these things were flaws, and now I found that they're not flaws, they're part of autisticness.
Mm.
But you're almost saying, not completely the other way around, you're not saying that they're flaws, but you're saying, well, I thought these were really interesting quirks, but actually they're much more common and loads of people have got them.
Yeah, I think for me it's 50-50 sort of things that were damaging to me and things that were not, that I liked about myself. And it doesn't change any of that, but it's just quite jarring to be told that these things that you thought were intricate parts of your unique personality are traits of a disability. Mm. And it really sort of shocked me a bit. And it was my fault, because I hadn't done enough research before going to my assessment. And, you know, that's dumb. But, yeah, it was odd. But that's not to say it sort of diminishes any of those things. It's helpful, because now I know what they are. You know, now I know what's going on a little more, and I can sort of deal with them and relate to them in a healthier way, I guess, I hope.
So what are these unique things that we're talking about?
I mean, you want the good ones or the bad ones?
Give us a mix.
I mean, the good ones
first, yeah.
Yeah, good ones are... And I kind of shy away from, you know, this autism thing of going, oh, it's our superpower. And it's like, it doesn't really feel like a superpower. I don't think I should be crying this much if it was a superpower.
Your superpower is crying.
Yeah, it's just staring at the wall going, what's going on? But the good things, you know, I'm a circus performer. I'm an artist. I apart from performing, which I've done all my adult life, 36, 7 years, I also write. I make YouTube videos. I'm a photographer. I think I'm quite good at making things. And I think that is an autism thing. I think the fact that I can hyper-focus on learning how to do something. I've always said that of all the skills that I've got, the only actual skill I've got is that I can learn something well. Mm. I know how to practice things. You know, so like, I mean, obviously I'm a juggler and a circus performer, so I've learned all these physical skills. But like when lockdown happened and all my gigs vanished, fun time, I spent a year learning everything I could about how to make videos, about cinematography and, you know, and opened a YouTube channel. And so I think I'm quite good at that. I think that feels like an autism thing. Bad things are, at the moment, right now, I want to run away. I want to jump out window and run away and hide under a desk.
In life, or this specific
podcast?
Are we making this happen?
No, you're not making me uncomfortable, but, you know, you are part of the universe, and the universe makes me uncomfortable.
Okay.
It's not on you. It's funny that so we met at the London Podcast Festival,
mm-hmm.
and I'd done a Jordan Jesse's podcast, and it was just after I'd got my diagnosis, and that night was the first time that something happened to me, and I sort of went, ooh, that's autism, you know, and I could suddenly reframe it in the moment. So I was in the green room, and a podcast finished recording, No Such Thing as a Fish, and they all came in, and they were all chatting, so noisy, and they were all talking, and I was realizing that I was getting really grumpy and feeling spiky, and then I went, oh, this is overstimulation. I know what this is now. So I found Jesse and I said, I'm feeling overstimulated. I'm autistic. I'm just going to go somewhere quiet. And I did. And I wouldn't have known to do that a month before. And I would have just sat there feeling smaller and smaller and feeling like everyone else is really good and talented and I am nothing and rubbish and I'm now really grumpy at the world and I want to run away and hide under a desk.
It's such an enabling thing once you can do that, can't you? Where it's sort of you go, oh, I can function now because I can just go, oh, I'll step outside for... Usually the things, well, for me anyway, I don't know if it's said for you, the things that I need are fairly small, actually, but it's just knowing that I can ask for them.
Yeah, yeah, and having that label to attach to it, so I can say, I'm autistic, I'm feeling this, I'm going to go and do this. And it's nice and clear and simple, and pretty much anyone hearing that would go, okay, cool, you know. Whereas in the past it was like, I don't know why I'm feeling this way. You know, I always sort of say... Because before my autism diagnosis, I also have, I've got, you know, I have depression and anxiety and epilepsy, and all of these things are quite hard to describe to people without a simple label. And it's, you know, it's if you don't know what the pain is and where it's coming from, it's really hard to deal with it, and it's really hard to tell people about it. You know, if you broke your leg, but you didn't know anything about what a broken leg was, that would be terrifying.
Mm.
So as soon as you know, as soon as I know what autism is, I can say that is what that is, and it's just a lot easier.
Yeah,
that make any sense?
Yeah, no, totally.
I find it's very easy to like as well to project and to be, feel like I, in the past, if I've been in that position, I'd be like, "These no such thing as the fish guys, they're assholes. They're so noisy and rowdy and horrible, right?" And they're not. They're very lovely people. We met them too. But I think there's very easy to. You, I guess if you don't have that narrative, you go, "Let's find another narrative. What is it? Is it exactly. These people are noisy and horrible, or I'm rubbish, or like you know?" And usually, it's a sort of negative narrative you look for,
yeah.
Rather than "Oh, I just need to do this yeah. thing." Yeah,
and I've certainly been guilty of that in the past. You know, in the industry that we work in, we're always in rooms with other performers and other makers. And, yeah, it's really easy in that situation to fall down a hole of they're all arseholes and they're all more successful.
I mean, there are some arseholes.
Yeah. There are some arseholes. But no such thing as a fish, as far as I know. Lovely.
But, yeah, and it is always overwhelming when you're in a room with, like, a group of people who know each other very well and you don't know them so well, and then it's loud and it's noisy, and then it's like, should I join in? But they have a thing going, and I like the social interaction there, along with getting overwhelmed by like the noise and everything, is just always like what, as me and my partner Tom say, and Tom is autistic ADHD. It's like sometimes it's just hard to people. Sometimes you don't know how to people.
Yeah.
And you're sitting there being like, what's the best way to people in this moment?
Yeah. It's a real, I think, I don't know for everyone or just for us, but it's a real skill to be learned, you know, which I don't think I have yet.
I don't, well, I mean, I don't want to say, you know, you definitely have it, but it's, as a neurodivergent performer, I find it so interesting how, and Joe, you've talked about it, how we present one way on stage, ergo people assume that that is the way we are. Like, you've talked about how people are like, oh, you don't seem autistic, or but you can make eye contact, whereas it's like, I'm not making eye contact. I'm standing on stage.
Oh, yeah.
There's 100 of you.
That's a comment on a video about me making eye contact. I'm on stage. I'm just looking into light.
Yeah.
The stereotype I'm breaking is looking into bright light. That's what I'm doing. It's not the eye contact one.
That's funny. Yeah. No, I have that on my... I did a few YouTube videos about my diagnosis, and you get the comments that say, well, you know, I've looked at your channel and I see you performing, so you can't be that autistic. And I do not understand the first thing about performing or autism. I've always said that the version of myself I present on stage is the version of myself I would like to be in real life.
Mm.
He's cool, he's witty, he knows what he's doing. Off stage, I don't know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think that on stage, for me, that on stage version of me, he's also autistic, and in some ways is more autistic because it's not trying to navigate other stuff. It's just being more, I feel more myself on stage, and myself is autistic. But I think the trap people fall into is we only see autism as struggle. So if you see someone not struggling, which usually doesn't happen on stage for me, then you go, well, they're not autistic because autistic people are struggling inherently. And I think that's the trap that we can fall into.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah.
I mean, it is interesting that people would watch you perform and be like, you're not, quote unquote, that autistic, when you're like, I'm a juggler. Do you know the time it takes to learn how to juggle a bowling ball?
Yeah. I can put a tablecloth on a table underneath all the things. Does that sound holistic to you? I mean,
you can put the tablecloth on.
Yeah.
Wow.
First person in the world to ever learn to do it.
Right.
Which is, I haven't decided if that's
is that first a person cool to try or
massively sad. It may be both.
How long did that take to figure out how to put it back on?
It took, well, because it hadn't been done before, I had to figure out the way of doing it, whether it was in fact possible.
You know?
So it took a few weeks of playing in my... I had a little bed set in Wood Green. And I had this folding table that once I folded it open, it would fill up virtually all of my living space. So it took a few weeks of playing with that until it worked once. And that's the worst thing. When it works once, you go, oh, shit, it worked. So it is possible. So now I have to learn it.
Yeah.
And because I do it for a living, I have to learn it to the point where it works every single time.
Yeah.
That's years. That was years.
Wow.
Stupid job.
That's amazing, though. Well, I mean, just the dedication of... I feel like that might be a difference right there sometimes between... autism and ADHD is like, it worked! Moving on to the next bright, shiny thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
I can juggle three balls. Are you impressed by that?
I'm not impressed. I mean...
And I can do... Can you do the lock and arm thing?
The what?
Where you drop a ball and you go like that.
I can
and
then do that. Like,
yeah.
Can you do it once? Just... Well, I can do
yeah,
it.
Yeah, just once.
Forever.
I like the idea.
It's my job, though. I mean, you know.
Joe, I just want to point out you basically were like, I know a knock-knock joke. Do you know any...
I can talk into a microphone. Yeah. It's not, no, it's good. Do you enjoy the act of juggling? Because it can be a nice...
No. I did a job where they sold juggling balls.
Ah, so you just...
And so I over 3 years, that was all I got. Yeah.
I'm sorry about that.
See, I find juggling... Like, I've always wanted to learn how to do it, and it's not that I haven't had the opportunity. When I was a kid, my dad could juggle, and he had three juggling balls, and after dinner he'd take them out and juggle for us, and he tried to teach us how to juggle. He even bought me scarves because, you know, they move slower, so that's a good way to start, and like taught me how to throw the ball from one side to the other and then like move, you know, all this stuff. Broke it down for me, and I didn't have the focus. I didn't have the focus because I wasn't diagnosed yet. So I didn't have the meds, so I didn't have the focus. But yeah, it seems like such a time. I mean, it is a time consuming performance art, isn't it? Like, because like you said, it has to be right every time.
Yeah. It's like I have a particularly kind of, what's the word? Sort of high profile-ish gig next weekend, and I'm doing a routine in it that I haven't done for a while. So every day, including today when I go home, I'm doing an hour of practice on one trick just to make sure that I don't screw it up.
Can I ask what the trick is?
It's literally just juggling six balls, but I don't normally juggle six balls in my standard sort of set.
Yeah,
I only do it in my hour-long show, and I'm doing my hour, so I just want to make sure that I don't drop, because there's nothing worse than having a big gig and being here's, you know, this great juggler and I'm dropping.
It's one of those things, as soon as you get it wrong, the whole audience go, this guy's shit. Well, if they've been juggling six for 5 minutes.
To an extent, which is why, you know, the smart jugglers like me learn to also be comedians.
Right.
Because, you know, you can spend 5 years on learning a trick, or you can just sit in a coffee shop and write some jokes and it's the same reaction. But what I always say is, if you're a magician and you get a trick wrong, that's it, you're dead in the water. There's no going back. There's no,
right,
you know,
yeah.
That, is that your card? No. Yeah. You know, as a juggler, if you drop, you can pick it up and do it again, try again, and the audience is with you more.
Mm.
If you frame it right, they want you to succeed and they respect the fact that you're trying again.
Because it's like you create almost like an underdog scenario.
Yeah, because you're struggling against something that is obviously difficult.
Yeah.
So if you say, well, I didn't get it that time, I'm going to try it again for you. It's like, oh, bless him, you know. Hopefully. That's what I rely on.
Why juggling? I assume you got into it as a child.
I got into it as a teenager.
Okay.
Yeah, as a youngish teenager. I saw a street performer when I was on holiday with my parents, and I saw a street performer, and I had not the happiest of childhoods. And I saw this guy doing street shows by bandstand in Yorkshire. And it blew my mind. And he was a juggler. He wasn't very good, but he was funny and he was a good showman, you know. But the art of street performing, which I hadn't really seen up until that point, he just took a corner of a car park by a bandstand and transformed it by his craft and his wit and his force of will. He transformed it into a theatre. And he created a venue out of nothing, gathered an audience, did a show, gave them something special. And then when he finished, it was back to being nothing. And that's That is magical. That is legit magical, you know. So it was an arts festival, so I watched him every single day. And by the time, you know, by the time the holiday was over, I wanted to be him. I went home, went to the pet shop at the end of our street and bought 3 rubber dog balls and got a book from the library on how to juggle. That was it.
I was really scared about how that pet shop was going to go. Juggling hamsters. Yeah. that is the thing that's amazing about street performance, which I'm very jealous of, is that being able to just create theatre anywhere.
Because
we're like, if we show up and the chairs aren't set up right, then we get very upset.
Out. Yeah. Ceiling's too high.
Yeah.
Chairs are facing the wrong way. Well, it's over.
It's everything I learned about performing, I learned from being a street performer. You know, if you can learn to work in a place where there is no infrastructure, there is no audience, and if you can make a living out of that, then any other venue in the world is not a problem. You know, you can work anywhere.
Yeah. Do you still street perform?
A little bit, yeah. I'm lucky enough that I'm kind of known enough in that world that I get invited to do sort of street performing festivals in far-flung places. Mm. So I do a couple a year because it's so much fun. So much fun. Yeah. So this year I'm doing one in Canada, a couple in Europe, Switzerland, yeah.
So when we started this, you said that, I think we said this on mic, but that as you're newly diagnosed, you're also here to learn.
Mm.
Now, Joe and I are just comedians. We're not authorities or heavily researched people on neurodivergency. However, do you have any questions, or is there any quandaries that you've realized, that's not the right phrase, but is there anything that's come up that's made you think, I wonder why?
That's a good question. I mean, I think, yeah, my kind of, you know, I mean, like we said, it's been less than a year since I got diagnosed, so it feels really early days. And it is more painful than I thought it would be.
Mm.
It's the whole thing is more than I thought it would be. I thought it would be a kind of, oh, that's interesting information, next. And it's not that. It feels, for me at least, much weightier and much more important. I read the book Unmasking Autism by Devon Price.
Oh, yeah, I haven't read it, but I heard it's good.
I think it's good. And so it's like, right, I should work on unmasking. That will make me feel less weird, feel less exhausted, you know. But I'm not sure what that entails. I don't know how, you know, and I think I've started doing it. But there's no roadmap. There's no, here's what you do now, you know.
I think the thing I found, which I talk about this in my show, which is on YouTube, is that if you've been masking your whole life from a very young age, you've learned to do. So the example I give is the, like, how are you? I'm fine, thanks, how are you? And when I was young, I didn't do that, but I was taught to do it. And now I always say, I'm fine, thanks, how are you? And it feels really weird to not do that. So the thing that I used to do as a kid that was natural to me now is unnatural to me because of sort of, you know, you train yourself to mask. So it can be a really complicated process, trying to think about, you know, what actually is my natural self, because I've learned all these rules and those rules then become, you know, I'm sure it's like any learned skill. If you learn the skill, it becomes a natural skill. It's like driving or whatever.
Mm. Yeah, I think it feels like it's just a case of kind of, I don't know, just, this sounds really hippy-dippy, just kind of listening to myself a bit and just kind of, you know, letting things happen.
Well, I think the example of being in a green room that's too loud and just like being like, I need a moment to step out, like, to me, like, that's unmasking, is like knowing your needs and getting them. So
I
feel like sometimes when we talk about unmasking, it suggests not necessarily performative, but like to act a certain way in public, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas I think sometimes unmasking is just stating your needs and then getting them, which doesn't have to be like a public thing, like you going off into a corner and just explaining why is unmasking. So then also no one's like, where'd Matt go? Or why isn't Matt talking to us? And like they know it's like, okay, Matt just needs his me time.
Yeah.
Like I think that's that's an example of unmasking.
I think that's such a good point, isn't it? Because I think we have, it's easy to feel like unmasking, is about looking more autistic.
Yeah.
And, you know, that you owe it to the autistics to look more autistic so that you're more visible. And if you don't look autistic enough, you're letting people down. And I think that it's easy to feel that way. But that sort of stuff you're talking about is unmasking just as much as...
Well, like you said, just sitting with yourself and asking what you need. Because, unmasking doesn't mean performing autism or neurodivergency. Unmasking means getting what you need out of the situation. So, yeah, I mean, if it's more comfortable for you at this point in your life to say, how are you? I'm fine. How are you? Then, and if that makes you feel like you're in a safe space, then I don't feel like you have to change it. Unless you want to, you know? And especially if you're with like a close friend, how are you? Well, let me freaking tell you, you know? Also, Joe and I've talked about this. I don't think we've talked about this on mic, but how the idea of unmasking can actually be kind of like a privileged thing.
Oh, yeah.
Like sometimes you have to do it. Like you just have to do it. You know, you can't, you know, if you're on a train that's overcrowded and it's really freaking you out, you have to just pretend you're fine. You can't stand in the train car and be like, excuse me, I need space. I need five of you to leave this train. You can't do that. You have to find a safe way for yourself to get through it.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm just repeating what you've told me, Joe. That's
sorry, and I'm going, you're really, that's a really, you're good, like, point.
You're the one who brought up to me how masking is a privilege, or unmasking is a privilege, excuse me.
Yeah. I think also we work in the arts, and I think there's a thing in the arts where you sort of, people who are very unmasked and very like, you see them as very unusual and different. I think we're sort of like, oh, those people are so interesting and cool. And I think there's, sometimes I feel a bit of sort of, someone like Sumita, who we've had on the podcast before, you know, who's a very like unmasked person. Like, I'm sort of quite jealous of the way she's able to, you know, be an unusual person and be proud of that. And I think that like, there is that bit of like, oh, I wish I could be properly unusual and you know, and be my sort of authentic different self. But yeah, it's a process.
Yeah.
Do you think, this is a heavy question, so feel free to answer it or not, but do you think things would be better or worse if you had the diagnosis earlier?
I don't know, because, you know, if I'd been diagnosed when I was at school, I mean, you know, back then there just wasn't the care or the infrastructure to help. There wasn't, you know, that's why I didn't get diagnosed, because, you know, I was in school in the 70s, and the only, you know, back then the only autistic kids were the ones who didn't talk and, you know, had very serious problems functioning, you know. I don't know. It's so hard, you know. It would have been nice to have not spent so much of my life in confused pain. But, you know, like you say, all of that gets me here. And he was fine. He was good. I like here. You know, I've got a very privileged life. I get to be an artist and, it's all good. But, you know, would I have got here had I been diagnosed earlier and been funneled in slightly different directions by an infrastructure? I don't know.
That's something I think people forget, is that like it's easy to go, oh, if I'd been diagnosed earlier, but you wouldn't have been diagnosed
in 2024. Oh, I would
have been
diagnosed
that. Yeah, you would have been diagnosed for me, like, in the 90s, like, where, like, the whole picture was very, very different. Yeah, what I really want is to be 20 years younger and be diagnosed now.
I have a bit of a fun question. You said, like, one of your great skills is that you're able to learn, which is such a beautiful skill. And you're right, not everyone has it. What is one of the more exciting things that you've learned, either in your life or in recent, that you've gotten into?
I learned to pick locks. That was fun.
You are not the first person on this podcast.
Big lock picking, base. Yeah,
that was fun. What have I learned to do? Well, I mean, when I was younger, I learned because I also have epilepsy, and I learned. I started learning Tai Chi to kind of bring myself down a little bit when I felt an epileptic seizure coming.
That's like the slow motion karate thing.
A slow motion karate, right, okay. Yes.
I don't think that's a technical description.
It's a soft style Chinese kung fu.
Okay.
So from there, I, you know, again, hyper focus martial arts. So I learned every martial art. I've been a student of, okay, let's do this. Taijutsu, Jujutsu, Eskrima, various styles of Kung Fu and Wushu, Aikido, Japanese swordsmanship. I'm a specialist in short-form weapons.
Oh, wow.
And it's not because I want to be all macho and, you know, I'm a walking weapon. I just like learning things. And it's like, there's all these nice things you can do with, like, nice shapes with your hands. And it's art and science. And at the same time, it's beautiful. But there's no real-world use for that. I very rarely get attacked by ninjas.
Are you always going down those sort of rabbit holes of like what are you in? What rabbit hole are you in at the moment?
I mean, I guess I'm still sort of stuck in the filmmaking thing. It's interesting because I have a YouTube channel and I upload videos to that and to Instagram and stuff. And so much of that culture is about the number of views and the follows and the, you know, here's how to get your audience to subscribe and here's how to get you, and that's all so boring. So I quite like just making, you know, nice looking pieces of video. So I quite like that, quite into that. And I'm doing a lot of writing. I'm writing my second book at the moment.
Do you think, because I write as well, and I felt growing up that the way I was taught to write did not work for me because it wasn't like it didn't have that like problem solving functional working out how language works thing. And once I learnt that writing was a sort of problem solving exercise to some extent, that changed my ability to write so much. It wasn't just something that you just open up and the writing comes out. Have you found that?
It feels like I'm doing it wrong.
Oh, right.
I don't know. I mean, I don't think I was ever really taught to write.
Right.
You know, at school, I didn't go to a very good school. School was not good for me. I don't really know. I just know that I think what I pursue is making things.
Right.
And all I really know is that the two times I feel the most like a grown-up in my life is when I'm on stage in a suit being all witty. That's me. And when I'm, like, after this, I'm going to go down to Bar Italia and I'm going to get a sandwich and I'm going to do a couple of hours of writing.
Mm.
I never feel more like a grown-up than that. That is what grown-ups do. They go to a cool coffee bar and they do some writing. I'm an artist.
Yeah.
That's great. And then I'll go home and go, oh, I'm pretending to be a grown-up. I'm not, though. That's all I know about writing. Yeah. Doesn't bode well for the book, does it?
No, I think it doesn't necessarily mean I'm a better writer. I think I'd overanalyze it and, but for me it was like, I had a thing where I was like, oh, I can, I'm articulating it poorly, ironically. If I wrote this down, I could articulate it very, very well.
Yeah.
But to me, there was a clicking point where I was like, oh, this is, I can change things around and move things. I was always interested in, like, when people talk about, like, subclauses and all the stuff that, like, that actually a lot of teachers hate of having to teach in English, where it's, like, sentence structures and conjunctions and stuff like that. I was always really fascinated by that. And, like, what if you put that at the beginning of the bit of the sentence, at the end of the sentence, and
I like that you can structure a piece of writing the same way that I would structure, like, an act, you know, with a sort of strong opening, and then there's a call to the end part, but then you do a little turn. You know, the same, because my act's got quite a tight structure. I quite like that.
What exactly are you putting on your YouTube channel? Tell me about your YouTube channel.
Okay. Well, you know, what they say on YouTube is what you need to do is you need to release videos regularly and also have them all be about the same topic. So I don't do that because I'm not good at this. So I release videos whenever I feel like it, and they're about all sorts of things. I mean, I've done a few videos about autism. I did one after my diagnosis about how it felt. I did one covering some of the comments I got from idiots after that first video. You know, I'm sure you've experienced the autism isn't really a thing brigade. So I've done a few sort of, I guess, video essays. Is that what they're called? Is that what the kids call them? You know, where I talk.
A vlog. Is it a vlog?
Is it a vlog? I don't know.
Andrew, our producer, is a young person.
Are you a young person? Right. Yeah. So I don't know. When I talk to a camera about a thing.
Is that TikTok?
Is it TikTok?
It's just a YouTube video.
Am I OnlyFans?
Its own category. Yeah, it depends if you're monetizing it, I suppose, and indeed naked. No, I think it's just a video. A YouTube video can exist as a two-camera piece, yes.
Two cameras?
Two-camera, sorry. Yeah.
Not using enough cameras, that's not true, right?
So I do... You know, videos where I talk about a subject, and I, you know, sometimes that's autism, sometimes that's something more artistic. I did one about AI a couple of weeks ago, which nobody liked.
But you didn't have to write it, so.
Exactly. I should have just done that. And then also I do kind of, because I travel a lot for my work, so I take my cameras with me and I do little sort of tour videos, you know. Mm-hmm. I just like making visual things, you know. It's a nice process to sort of work hard to make something look interesting visually, you know, rather than just, hi guys, here I am in a place, you know. It's easy to do it. Not that I'm dissing any other YouTubers, although I'm happy to. But you know,
we don't want beef with other YouTubers. That's not
come at me.
That's not diss the YouTubers.
Come at me, Casey Neistat. Think you're so yeah, you are. You're very rich and very, very good. But yeah, it's just a nice, you know, because I'm old. So the internet happened while I was already doing this. Not YouTube videos, obviously, that would make no sense. But I was already a performer when the internet
happened.
Was born. So it's still quite a novelty to me, the ability to make work and just throw it out into the world and see who likes it. And why, and see what people think of it. That's still, so I think that's what I get out of all the things I make online, is just here's something I think or feel, or here's something I saw, and you make it look interesting and throw it out and see what comes back. And that's nice.
Yeah. I gotta be honest, that sounds like really freeing, because like you said so many times with making content for the internet, it's like you have to make it regularly, you have to find a niche, or it all be about one thing. And I think that's really beautiful that you're like, I'm just making videos because I like them, and I will release what I like when I choose. I think that's such a healthier way than social media has done some positive things and it's done some negative things. And I think specifically for performers, the worst thing it's done is made performers stop thinking about what they want to do and made them to start think about what the algorithm wants them to do, or what would grab a large audience as opposed to the right audience. Yeah. And I think that's really beautiful.
Thank you. Yeah, because once you do that, you're working for a boss.
Yeah.
Mm. And they're not your boss, you know. And I think everything I learned about content creation I learned from street performing. You go out on the pitch, you do the idea you had, and if people want to stop, they stop and watch. If they want to give you some money, they do. And that's the kind of ethos that I take into everything that I make. It's, you know, here's what I think is interesting or of emotional value or good to look at or whatever, and if you want to stop and watch, you can stop and watch, you know.
I think that's the answer to, like, all, like, creative things, isn't it? Is make stuff that is good and that you like and that you...
Yeah.
Believe in. And I think you do, like, you know, not to name one, but you do see some newer comics and creative people generally who are very thinking about, you know, the algorithms and blah blah blah, and they're often not that good because they're not thinking about what do I want to do, what's authentic to me.
Yeah.
And there's a few comics out there who are very good and don't, you know, and haven't got the respect that they deserve, but generally, if you keep doing good stuff, it will find its way eventually.
Yeah, and it might not get you might not get huge and a million billion views, but that shouldn't be why you do it. And I'm very lucky. I make I make an okay living from live performing. I don't need to make a lot of money out of things like YouTube. You know,
mm-hmm.
I can afford to be an artist on YouTube. But still, that is what it's for. It is art. You know.
Yeah. It's supposed to be fun, guys.
It's supposed to be fun.
That's what I try to remind myself is that, like, the reason I do comedy was to slack off from work. And sometimes when I'm working really hard or stuff, I think, oh, no, I'm not meant to be... This is meant to be messing around. Because I've realised at school that I like to show off. And that I went, oh, I could make a living just showing off and not doing the work. And as soon as it starts to feel like work, I realise I'm doing it wrong.
Yeah. It's, you know, we all got into
and
this.
And those comments are going to really hurt when I'm editing this podcast at 2 a.m. Going, oh, it does feel like
it
work.
It does feel like work. Fuck. Matt, we're coming to the end here. Do you have anything to plug? Specifically, what's the name of your YouTube channel?
On all the internet things, I am Matt Ricardo. That's 1 T in Matt. Plug that name into your internet, social media, or entertainment platform of choice. Come and look at my YouTube videos, subscribe, and come and say hi.
And do you have any shows coming up, or are you going to be at any festival soon or anything like that? If the answer is no, we'll cut this part out.
Yeah, the answer is basically no.
Okay.
I'm on tour with a burlesque show at the moment, which is filling up my whole year, which is really good. It's really fun.
What's the burlesque show?
It's called An Evening of Burlesque. It tours big theatres all over the country. I get to do 15 minutes in it.
Well, I mean, people can go see that.
People can go see
that. Yeah, that's on tour.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's full of, you know, cool people flouncing around in nice outfits.
Oh, I love
that. Do you get a nice outfit?
Of course I do.
Actually, here, at the very end, I have a random question. Do your suits and your waistcoats and all the fabulous clothes you wear on stage, do you get them tailored?
Some of them, yeah.
Because you always look freaking good.
And thanks.
The outfit's good, but the fit.
Thanks.
The fit is just...
Thanks very much. I mean, you know, again, autism, you know, formal menswear, it's all about rules and history and learning.
Yeah.
That's, you know, I used to be a brand ambassador for a tailor's called Walker Slater. For a couple of years, I was their brand ambassador. They used to give me free suits.
Wow.
Free custom tailored suits. And I no longer have that. If Walker Slater are listening, I would be absolutely happy to go back into that contract.
Oh, whoa.
Oh, that was good.
That's amazing.
We'll put that out as a clip.
So yeah, there we go.
Tag them in.
Tag them in.
I want some Walker Slater as well. No, I don't like wearing a suit. Do you Covercane suits though? Well, obviously you do.
I
don't cope well in suits.
No, yeah.
That was also a big motivation for me going to the arts, was not wearing a suit.
Suits are my kind of comfort suit of armour.
Right.
When I put on a suit before I work, it makes me feel like, you know, it makes me feel a bit stronger. Yeah.
Also, I would argue that a well-tailored or well-fit suit feels different than, like,
I'm only ever asked
off the rack.
Yeah. Matt, do you have a neurodivergent moment for us?
Okay. So when I went to get, and I'm sure this is common for a lot of people, that by the time you go for your autism assessment, by the time you're through the door, you're already pretty sure. You know, all the stuff that's got you there, you're like, I just need to have this written in ink, you know. So I went into my assessment, and there was a very lovely lady, and I sat down in her room, and I got a free coffee, marvellous. And she said, did you find the place okay? And I was like, yeah, no, fine. And she said, it's funny, some people, actually quite a lot of people who turn out to be autistic that I see, they say that they actually came here like an hour earlier just to make sure that they knew where it was so it all felt familiar, you know. And there was a beat, and I said, yeah, I came here yesterday. And then I had to admit to her that before I went there yesterday, I went to Google Earth in my VR headset so that I could walk the journey in VR. So I think at that point we could have gone, yeah, let's just stamp it. I can leave. We're done.
Give the assessor a day off. Yeah. Wonderful.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Do you get a nice outfit?
Of course I do.
Actually, here at the very end, I have a random question. Do your suits and your waistcoats and all the fabulous clothes you wear on stage, do you get them tailored?
Some of them, yeah.
Because you always look freaking good.
And thanks.
That, the outfit's good, but the fit. Thanks. The fit is just...
Thanks very much. I mean, you know, again, autism, you know, formal menswear, it's all about rules and history and learning.
Yeah.
That's, you know, I used to be a brand ambassador for a tailor's called Walker Slater. For a couple of years, I was their brand ambassador. They used to give me free suits.
Wow.
Free custom tailored suits. And I no longer have that. If Walker Slater are listening, I would be absolutely happy to go back into that contract.
Oh, whoa.
Oh, that was good.
That's amazing.
We'll put that out as a clip.
So yeah, there we go. Yeah,
tag them in.
Tag them in. Tag them in.
I want some Walker Slater as well. No, I don't like wearing a suit. Do you cobricane suits, though? Well, obviously you do.
Do I
don't cope well in suits.
No, yeah.
That was also a big motivation for me going to the arts, was not wearing a suit.
Suits are my kind of comfort suit of armour.
Right.
When I put on a suit before I work, it makes me feel like, you know, it makes me feel a bit stronger. Yeah.
Also, I would argue that a well-tailored or well-fit suit feels different than, like,
I'm only ever asked
off the rack.
Yeah. Matt, do you have a neurodivergent moment for us?
Okay. So when I went to get, and I'm sure this is common for a lot of people, that by the time you go for your autism assessment, by the time you're through the door, you're already pretty sure. You know, all the stuff that's got you there, you're like, I just need to have this written in ink, you know. So I went into my assessment, and there was a very lovely lady, and I sat down in her room, and I got a free coffee, marvellous. And she said, did you find the place okay? And I was like, yeah, no, fine. And she said, it's funny, some people, actually quite a lot of people who turn out to be autistic that I see, they say that they actually came here like an hour earlier just to make sure that they knew where it was so it all felt familiar, you know. And there was a beat, and I said, yeah, I came here yesterday. And then I had to admit to her that before I went there yesterday, I went to Google Earth in my VR headset so that I could walk the journey in VR. So I think at that point we could have gone, yeah, let's just stamp it. I can leave. We're done.
Give the assessor a day off. Yeah. Wonderful.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much
for
coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
That was Matt Ricardo.
I think he's brilliant.
He's brilliant and thoughtful and wonderful, yeah. Go and check out his stuff.
I really like what he had to say about making videos for YouTube. So far, he's the only person I've ever talked to who makes videos online who's just making them for enjoyment and not putting the pressure of production and getting followers and stuff. He's just having a good time.
And if you haven't heard that conversation, it's because I put it in the Patreon, and you can sign up for the Patreon at patreon.com/neurodivergence. Oh god, I don't know, it's been so long. It's been away.
Patreon neurodivergent moments.
It'll be in the episode description.
Yeah, if you have the app, you know how to do it. I like that's what I called out, and you in your head are like, that's the part that goes in the Patreon. You already know.
No, I don't know, but just in case it does.
Okay,
yeah,
fair
I'm
enough.
Covering myself.
Joe, do you, should we do some audience? We were going to do neurodivergent moments.
Yes.
But it appears that we don't have any in the email. So we're going to answer.
So this is a plea for neurodivergent moments in the email.
If you could send them, because I forgot to send a call out. Email us your neurodivergent moments at neurodivergentmomentspod@gmail.com. But we have some questions.
One of the things I'm wondering, if a couple of tips for what I think makes a good neurodivergent moment.
Okay, because you've been doing them wrong.
No, you haven't been doing them wrong. They've all been wonderful. But the ones we've liked the most have been about a paragraph long, about a specific thing that happened.
Mm-hmm.
We generally don't do ones about neurodivergent kids, so people like from parents about their kids.
If it's about you, if you have a neurodivergent kid, we usually don't talk about your children. We usually talk about the person emailed
us. Neurodivergent parent talking about parenting, we do that. Yeah,
yeah.
And yeah, those are some little tips for you.
Yeah,
because I know, but I like to have like a word count, or like to know how long a thing should be.
Yeah,
so I don't know whether that's helpful to about a paragraph. So
yeah,
maybe three or four sentences.
Yeah,
but if they're longer, we'll still enjoy them. We've had long ones we've enjoyed, we've had shorter ones we've enjoyed.
Yeah,
some lovely one sentence moments.
Yeah,
so don't feel constricted by that.
Like a haiku, a neurodivergent haiku.
That's what I want, neurodivergent haikus.
Oh, we're going to get some now. Yeah, I'm very excited for that.
Cool.
But today we have some leftover questions from our Q&A that we released on our Patreon. So we're going to answer some questions we haven't gotten a chance to answer yet.
Yes.
Cool. Do you want to start?
Should I go first?
Yeah, you go first.
So here is one. I don't know whether this person wants me to use their name. So, oh, yeah, happy for you to use my real name. Their real name is Chris Waller. So Chris Waller, wasn't that Biggie's real name?
I think so.
Maybe this has come from Biggie. No, probably not. It says, do you think that being gullible is a bit of an autistic or generally neurodivergent trait? I failed two internal phishing tests that have led to remedial training and today just fell for my third. There's just something in me that pushes rational, cautious thought out of the way and makes me take a fake email at face value. And it's as if my processing only catches up later and tells me that, yep, you've fallen for it again. I have thoughts on this. What, do you have thoughts?
I don't have any proof one way or the other, whether or not being gullible is a neurodivergent trait, except for I will say I am very gullible. Like if someone says something to me, I'll just believe them. Someone will have to explain to me that. Someone's
lying.
It's
the thing I've heard, and now I'm thinking about this, we should tell our listeners it's not actually the Notorious B.I.G. that's emailed us.
Oh, yeah.
Just in case that they thought I was just being silly. I think that there is that thing of like, well, why wouldn't someone? There's another way of framing this, isn't there? There's autistic people are gullible, and then there's neurotypical people are all liars. that's the way of framing it. But this is a thing that I have heard before. Yeah.
I would say anecdotally, there's something I think maybe it's that thing too. And we talked with Matt about this, and maybe it's in the Patreon, maybe it's in the episode about being self-righteous and like being neurodivergent people, being people who are people who have a strong sense of right and wrong and morality. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe gullibility comes down to that, because why would someone lie?
Why would you trick someone? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm quite good at picking up on the scam emails, though.
I can pick up on a scam email, but I've had people in my life, I'm sure you have too, that just lie about their life. Like they make stuff up about their life. And I just find that kind of fascinating, because you can't call them on it because they it's almost like pathological. And but I'm like, why would you make something up about yourself when who you are as a person is actually quite interesting?
Yeah, I think it often comes from an insecurity.
Yeah.
People don't feel they're good enough, so they have to make them.
Yeah.
I like the two extremes of it. I like people who are honest all the time, and I like absolute bullshitters, where I fully understand the rules of like, yeah, you're going to make some completely out there stuff up, and I'll just nod along.
Yeah.
I like that. I had a friend at school. Have I talked about this before?
I don't know.
I think I may have. So apologies if I've said this before, but he had a tarantula called John whose claws were so big that it bit out of the cage, and so that's why he didn't have the tarantula anymore when we were around his house. His brother was in the Navy. That was true. And then we're talking. So he was. I think he went. It was in the Iraq War. Mm-hmm. This is the second, the early 2000s one, and. And then my mate gets me, I'm at school, this is like 13, 14, gets me and my mate Jack round and he goes, "Here, lads, got something to tell you. It's not been announced yet, so, you know, let's keep it under hats, but my brother killed Bin Laden last night." And wow. We're talking like 2003, you know, this is years and years before Bin Laden was killed. But yeah, don't tell anyone, though.
Just keep it secret.
Hasn't reached the national news, but it's reached the secondary school in Waterlooville, where I live.
And at that time, did you know that he was a bullshitter?
I loved it. Brilliant.
That's what I mean when you can't call them out on it, because you're like, what's the point of saying this isn't true?
Mm.
You just kind of go, okay, all right, sure. Yeah.
It's a great story as well. I like to hear it. Yeah.
Oh gosh. All right. I have a question. I have another question, which I've just realized is also from Chris Waller, but he sent us two separate emails with wonderful two questions. So I thought we were going to do listener questions.
It's now Chris's.
It's just Chris's question. So thank you, Chris, for sending this in. I've got a general question about autism and ADHD partnerships. Basically, why do you think they're common? It feels it's a lot to do with the two of you complementing each other, and also is likely to be down to how we have similar but different experiences through lives. Specifically, how do autistics make peace, not just with the ADHD partner breaking rules, but with them seeming to be completely oblivious of them? So so why is there such a good partnership there, and how do autistic people, I think this is for you, Joe, make rules with the fact that ADHD partners break rules without even knowing that they're breaking rules?
I don't know if this is someone who came to see my show, because I talked about this a bit in the show. Yeah, you did the, which, and the thing is, I admire people. I really admire your rule breaking and what rebel you are. Do you remember when we were at the end of a Fringe? And
yes.
Oh my gosh.
You were so stressed.
At the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, we want to go and see a show. Some of this string of venues, some of them do a thing where it's like, you can buy a ticket, but if there's space, you can go in for free. So you can queue up for free. And if there's space, they'll let you in for free. But then for some, they change. This show wasn't doing that. And Abigail just confidently says to the staff, "Oh no, we work for the venue." So
I was with this venue, and I was with Joe and a bunch of our friends, and I just said, "We're all with this specific venue,"
which was a lie,
which was a bold-faced lie. And so they're sitting.
It's been a year now; they can't come for us.
So they're sitting there. What? We're waiting to see if we're allowed to go in as pass holders to this venue. And Joe's just standing there, and he just leans over and goes, "Guys, what if they don't let us in the show?" And I just turn to Joe and I go, "Then we go do something else." The thing is,
no, I wasn't a bit worried about not being let in the show. I was worried about them finding out we didn't work for the venue and going, "You broke the rules and you're bad."
A teenager working the door of a festival.
Yeah, they've got a lanyard.
They don't have a lanyard. That was my venue, and they fucked up on sending out the lanyard. That's why I knew we could lie, because I was like, no one has a lanyard, so they don't know that we're not with that venue.
And I want you to know that I really admire your ability to do that.
Thank you.
You're like a cool, like, outlaw, just breaking any rules, doing what you want. But it makes me anxious.
I feel like I can break rules when I find one. Sometimes I freak out and I lie. And Tom's like, "You can't do that. Don't lie to Border Patrol. They'll Google you." which only happened once. But if the stakes are so low, it doesn't bother me to get in trouble. Like, the worst thing that could have happened in that situation is that teenager who was running the door of that venue goes, "You don't have passes. I know you're not a part of this venue. Leave." Then we just shrug and leave. And in 2 days, they're not going to remember who we are because we're at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival and thousands of people pass.
Can you train me?
Yeah.
Okay.
You're doing great. But then a couple months later, Joe, you stole the mug.
Yeah, I know. That weighs heavy on me.
Oh, you were great. You were great.
I'm trying to get into crime. Okay, right.
But why do you think autistic and ADHD people pair?
Oh, no, I need to role play this. Okay.
Okay, sorry.
Oh yeah, no, it's okay. We don't take this, but we work for Just the Donut.
Yeah.
Oh god, I've named them now on the podcast.
It's okay.
The crime that we've committed.
I don't work for that venue anymore.
we work for the venue chain.
There you go. That's all you do. And you say it with a lot of confidence.
No, the thing I'm anxious about is if you then went, no, you don't. You're lying. You are a liar. That's what I'm scared of.
Well, okay. So role play it with me. I'll be like, hey, we're actually allowed to see the show because we work with the venue.
Oh, do you? Okay, can I see your passes?
We actually don't have our passes yet.
Actually, I know that you have a show, but who are these people? They don't work for them. This guy's on Free Fringe. This person isn't even a comedian. You're not allowed in here. You're trying to steal a show.
All right, well, you'll forget about this in 2 days.
Okay.
Your box office doesn't even work. I'm leaving.
This is we've brought in our own beef with it as well. Okay.
There you go.
I stole the mug. The mug.
You stole the mug.
They did tell me that I could take the mug. Is it stealing if you're given something? It's more of a present than stealing.
Here's the thing. You held it and went, I'm going to steal a mug. And you said it just loud enough that a venue member heard it, turned Joe, and went, actually, we want you to take that. So
I did that on purpose. Then I thought that if they got actually upset, then I could give it back and go, oh, I was only joking.
Yeah.
So I had a root in my head.
There you go. Yeah. I have a friend who used to shoplift when we were in college, and he said the best way to steal something is to walk out with it right in your hand, like visibly in your hand.
Awesome.
And he's like, because if they do catch you, then you can be like, oh, silly me. I forgot I was holding this. And then you don't get in trouble. If you put it in your bag, you're clearly shoplifting.
Right.
But if you just walk out holding an Hermes scarf, who are they to know that you weren't just accidentally carrying it in your hand?
Right. Yeah. Wow. On that crime tip.
And then why do you think autistic and ADHD people make the power couples that we do?
I think they are, apart from that sort of tension around rule breaking, I think they do work together. I think that, like, I know that you can navigate a lot of social things that I would find stressful. I'm sure I bring something to the, I do the editing.
I am good at navigating certain social situations, but I also think sometimes I get really worked up, and both you and my autistic partner, Tom, are really good at putting things in perspective when I can't see the trees through the forest. Mm. So when I get super overwhelmed, I think you're really good at being like, oh, that's fine. We can just do it this way, that's not a big deal. So yeah.
Unless it's about breaking minor rules. Yeah. In which case we lack all the perspective.
Yeah, and I'm here to drag you into crime. All right. We're going to get you a leather jacket. cool. Well, hey, do you have a personal neurodivergent moment?
I do. It's really embarrassing.
Do you want me to go first, or do you want to go first?
Let's get mine out of the way.
Okay, let's
I level with you, listeners. It's about my anus.
Okay, wow.
It's happening now. I had to go to the doctor for my anus. I'm all fine. I'm an awkward autistic person anyway. That awkwardness is heightened by the fact I've got to... I thought... Well, every other doctor that my doctor surgery I've seen has been like an old man... But the NHS is in crisis and now is like employing supermodels for the doctor shortage. So I was so awkward. And I'm an awkward person. And so awkward so that this doctor said, oh, and I'll refer you to the mental health team. And I was like, why? And she was like, oh, because like you're like a very stressed and anxious person. I was like, no, this is my personality. And also, I come from a really embarrassing doctor's problem. This isn't a crisis. This is every day. So that's my very embarrassing neurodivergent moment, is my natural personality being mistaken for severe mental illness.
Also, I feel like that's like not a good doctor to like. Who is that doctor that hasn't assessed the situation of? So the doctor was female.
Yeah, yeah.
Who was looking at your butt? Or just discussing your butt.
Yeah, it's just a discussion.
Okay, it's but even
there was a photograph that had to be shown. It was really embarrassing.
Okay, so there's a lot going on in that scenario that a doctor might go, hey, this young sweet man might be a bit uncomfortable with this situation, and instead she went, well, clearly you're ill because you are uncomfortable and anxious showing me a picture of your butt.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. Yeah,
I want to.
This guy's not making a lot of eye contact.
I want to free you from this embarrassment put it on the NHS.
Can you top that?
Not an embarrassment, but my neurodivergent moment is I was co-hosting The Guilty Feminist, and
that'll be out now, will it?
It'll be out later in. Coming up. I don't know when this comes out and when we record. But my point is I decided to get to the venue early, sit down with my notebook and come up with some research, the guests, and come up with some guilty feminist moments. What are they called? I'm a feminist butts. And I sat down at King's Place and I texted Tom Selinsky, the producer, saying, hey, I got here super early. I'm in the cafe. If you get here early and you want to have a coffee. And Tom messaged me back. We're recording the podcast next Monday. So I showed up a week and 2 hours early.
People say ADHD people are late, but they're not. They're early.
We're either late directly on time or very, 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 very early. But I confused the dates.
Bless you. I'm a feminist, but is what I said to the doctor. What? I was in my head, and I can get it out.
Awesome.
That's got to be the end.
Yeah.
I want that to be the end of the show, but that's where
that's how it's going to end. Guys, thank you so much for listening to our podcast. And let's look into the camera to say this, because I need to film a big information. We have a big live show coming up.
We do.
Tell them about it, Joe.
It is in Oxford. It is a live show. It is a pressure moment. We talk about having weird brains.
Yeah. So on May...
The people listening to this will know, but we're talking to the camera now. We've got two audiences.
At May 26th at the Old Firehouse Station in Oxford, we will be doing a live show. Please come out, buy your tickets. They will be linked everywhere on our social media.
See that.
Yeah, looking forward to it. Bye.